Well, and look, I think you're one of the things that I had to do when I joined AdMob is unlearn a whole bunch of the patterns that I had learned at Google. And Google was trying to solve a very different problem than AdMob was trying to solve. A lot of the problems that Google had at the time were these like super high ambition computer science problems where they were like right out on the frontier of technology. Like nobody had solved this stuff before. And you know, you sort of structure your environment to solve those problems well. And it felt, you know, like very much like a university. Like the transition from academia to Google was super soft. And like a lot of their process, like the promotion process there, felt a lot like the tenure process in academia. It's like committee driven. You sort of like, you know, you're accountable for your own outcomes. Like, so a lot of it felt very collegial and like, you know, they got really great results out of it. But like you take that and like stuff it into a startup like AdMob and like, you know, it just doesn't work. Like the thing that we had going for us at the time is like, we were trying to build this mobile advertising ecosystem, like not because like we thought that mobile ads were like inherently the best thing in the world, but because like if you'll sort of flashback, this is like pre-iPhone, you know, the thing that had driven AdMob's business up to the point where I joined, which was like right when the iPhone first came on the market, was WML advertising, right? So you had carriers who like had a deck where they decided like what was going to be on your phone. And like there was this chicken and egg problem for entrepreneurs where like they wanted distribution, like they wanted to be on the carrier's deck, but like the carriers weren't interested in cutting BD deals with companies that didn't have any traction. And so like the bootstrap was horrible. And like that was the problem AdMob was trying to solve. It's like, how can we get mobile entrepreneurs a distribution mechanism? And like, once they've got distribution and usage, like how can they monetize themselves? And like, that's a whole all stop, like the reason why we were doing that. And like the environment that we were in is like, you had to be able to sort of seize every first mover advantage that you could possibly get. So the thing that we had to design ourselves for, just from a culture perspective and from, you know, just from like an engineering process and infrastructure perspective, was agility. Like that was very different from Google, mm-hmm. Very different. And it's not even something that, you know, like then I bounced back into Google for a while and then I go to LinkedIn before the IPO. And like LinkedIn was, you know, another one of these big growth things. Like the engineering team was about 250 people when I joined. It was 3,100 engineers 6 years later when I stopped being head of engineering at LinkedIn and started being CTO at Microsoft. And I didn't do anything that I did at AdMob trying to set the culture for LinkedIn because it would have been insane.
Yeah. What is the good hygiene for setting up an engineering team in a small company? Let's say you go in at like, you know, AdMob was what, 10 people, 20
yeah,
people?
Yeah, about 10 engineers,
and
20
then
people.
When Google acquired them, you guys were what, 250 maybe?
No, we were like 140 people, like maybe 60 engineers.
So what's like a good engineering team at that point in your mind? You know, now you work with enough startups, enough big companies. So at that stage, what does an engineering team look like versus, let's say, you are at a pre-growth spurt company like LinkedIn?
Yeah.
And then and then you're like a big company, like maybe like, you know, post IPO LinkedIn.
Yeah. Any engineering team needs to understand what its role in helping the company win. Like we had this guy, Fred Kaufman, who worked with us at LinkedIn. And so like Fred's this interesting, like economist, philosopher, business consultant sort of guy. He's like written two really amazing books. Like one that I especially like is called Conscious Business. And like Fred would come in and like do these sessions with folks. And like he would ask everyone, it's like, okay, you've got a soccer team. What's the role of the goalie? And like everybody would like, you know, raise their hands and self-assuredly say, oh, the goalie's job is to keep the ball from going in the goal. And Fred would be like, no, that is not the goalie's job. The goalie's job is to help the team win. And sometimes it means the goalie has to get out of position. And so like having this clear notion as an engineering team about what it is that you need to be doing to help your company win is like probably the most important thing that you need to do, whether you're a tiny little startup or you're a big, you know, company like Microsoft with tens of thousands of engineers. And a lot of people get super confused about that because like they sort of assume they just sort of make a bunch of silly assumptions that are more based on their personal preference for what they would like the engineering team to be than like sort of the reality of like what the engineering team can contribute to the company's success. In some places, like you need to like be very engineering driven because like the essence of your business is solving a bunch of really hard technology problems. In other contexts, like, you know, you need to be sales driven because like the, you know, you've already invented something that's sort of useful and interesting. And like the challenge is getting that interesting thing connected with paying customers. And so like just being honest with yourself, and like, it's hard to create like that sort of whole company team where like you've got great people in all of the positions and like everybody's sort of willing to like do their role. If you like have a misconception that you're somehow the, you know, the star of the show when you're not.
That's an interesting point of view, you know, considering that, you know, you hear the story again and again where the business units and the engineering units are treated separately within a company, no matter how small or how big it is, that they try and keep them, you know, they have the business and product and engineering, and where you kind of look at that and, you know, it's like that makes no sense.
Yeah. And look, sometimes you need an individual team to sort of be able to assert itself. Yeah, I remember like one of the funny things at AdMob when I first got there is like it was a, I mean, it's a small company, but it like had a small sales culture. It was like, let's go out and like, you know, book deals. Like, you know, we need to bring in revenue, and like totally reasonable thing. But at the time I showed up, like we've been doing that to the exclusion of like actually investing in infrastructure. And like, you need to be doing both in sort of a balanced way, because this advertising business was only going to be successful at scale. And like, there was no way to like scale up your revenue if your infrastructure was falling over. And it was sort of weird. Like our traffic peaks at AdMob tended to be over the weekend. Like mobile consumption was like really a leisure activity at the time. And so like you'd have people like, you know, at the ball game on the weekend and, you know, they're checking scores or like out and about using their phone. And like, so weekends were a crap time. Like, and when I first got there, we were on the verge of collapse every weekend. It was all hands on deck. And, you know, like you're having to like tweak MySQL settings, you know, let's raise the connections to 700. It's almost like NASA, you know, command center. And, you know, at some point, like the team is fried and like you are, you know, we were trapped in this, and like a lot of companies get into this where you sort of get trapped into this sort of cycle of technical debt where you've accumulated so much that you're almost at the point where you can't even pay the interest on the debt.
Yeah.
And then you just got to stop. And so like, I've done this twice now, once at AdMob and once at LinkedIn. And it's like, look, we got to stop, you know, no more special sales deals. Like you can't, you know, sell an ad unit where, you know, like you're shaking the phone to like have a guy drop trousers for, you know, Dockers or whatever thing, you know, that somebody's willing to pay money for. Like we got to stop now and spend a couple of months like shoring up all of this infrastructure. Otherwise, like the business is going to collapse. And so like some of it is like moment in time things. Like you got to be able to do that. And then at other times it's like, look, you know, like we got this big deal we got to do. Like, you know, I'm not the star of this show. Like I need to come in and support this.
I think a lot of us have forgotten what it used to be. I mean, I've had many outage days on the GigaOm back in the day that, you know, first the Pearl would just kind of, you know, like the database couldn't handle anything. And then later in the MySQL, you know, would get jammed. And so like now you think about it, the cloud has become so pervasive that most people don't even think about such things, except for the credit card bill you get at the end of the month. That's a different story.
Yeah, but, and look, I think that's an incredible luxury. Like, we we were a little bit too early at AdMob to build on top of the cloud. So I was still, I was building a bunch of infrastructure, and like we had a data center team, and like we had system integrators building racks of gear for us. And like we had a architecture for an ad serving pod. And like we were, you know, it's like all a bunch of stuff that like, if I were doing it again, like you never do it that way. You just get all of this stuff from the cloud.
Let me ask you about, you know, now that it's like a nice segue from the past into the present, right? Yep. So you worked on advertising technology, which is viewed as, you know, advertising online is now viewed as a toxic product. Essentially, everybody dislikes it. Now, you flip it from your point of view, that of an engineer who worked on the actual technology of advertising at Google.
Yeah.
You look at the impact of that in terms of technology, that has been pretty huge, right? Like the sheer, like it was one of the first major robust data sets to be put to use on a real-time basis.
Yep.
I wonder how you think about, you know, the way people talk about advertising, the technical achievements of advertising. Like from an engineer's standpoint, how do you view that?
Yeah, so I think there's some amazingly innovative things that have happened with ad technology over the years. I don't know how big the systems are today, but, you know, like when I was running these ads quality systems, like the big machine learning systems at Google in 2007, like I'm pretty sure they were the biggest machine learning systems on the planet. Like it's just like epic scale what we were doing, and relatively little about me and mostly about like a very good group of people who were on that team. And the idea that we had in our heads then was, you know, not too dissimilar from this notion that we had at AdMob. Like we saw the advertising stuff as a facilitating technology for some, like it wasn't necessarily the greatest thing in and of itself, but it was, you know, like you think about search advertising in particular, like it's a much better way, or so we thought, to like get advertisers connected with people who like had the intent to go buy something. And you could sort of measure how effective it was just in terms of how that intent got translated into a transaction. And so like I always, you know, just as a consumer, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like I've spent 6 years of my life, I guess, like intensely working just on advertising stuff. And then like I've had a bunch of roles like, you know, at Microsoft and at LinkedIn where like we have advertising businesses and I sort of pay attention to what's going on there. But like it's not the thing that I'm spending all of my time on. But, you know, as a consumer, like search advertising, like I think, is a pretty non-intrusive way to do marketing. And like it sort of pays for this service that's like really useful. You know, I'm constantly doing this thought exercise about what did my world look like in 1982 when I was a 10-year-old? And what would that world look like now in Gladys, Virginia, where I grew up? And it would be dramatically different, largely because there is a like an ad supported consumer internet. Like I would not have had enough money as a child, like growing up the way that I grew up, to like buy a subscription to a search service or to buy a subscription to Wikipedia or like, you know, any of the many things that you just sort of take for granted that are free and ubiquitous right now. And so like, I think that's the thing that, you know, I think is good about advertising. You know, some of this stuff where, you know, like you're getting into this, you know, race to the bottom to figure out like how many compromises you can make to like wring every last cent out of this ecosystem. Like, I don't think that's a good thing at all. And I think, you know, we collectively could be doing a better job drawing a set of lines saying like, you know, this is enough. And like, you know, we need to be more transparent about what's going on. And
well, I think, you know, I mean, I've been around long enough to know that, you know, when Google, and I pick on Google, but it could be any company, right? And when you look at Google or you look at Twitter or you look at Facebook, once you go public, you're on a treadmill of growth.
Yep.
You have to do it. If you don't do it, your stock falls and you lose the employees and the companies go.
Yeah, I think you nailed it.
you become a Yahoo, right? That's essentially what happens if you don't keep up the growth. I think that is not to say that the company shouldn't go public. I think in 2019, when I think about capitalism, we've actually transcended into hyper-capitalism where growth has been metacized to a point it is only for the sake of growth, not for the sake of society. I think there is a very fine line where capitalism becomes essentially criminalism. And I kind of worry that you might be skirting it right now. Very few companies have the consciousness to fight that, you know, but the machine is set up to kind of spin out of control. I mean, that's how I sometimes worry about it. Not that I can, you know, I have any conclusive thoughts on it, but like I worry about that aspect.
Yeah, I think it's something where like we society should be spending more time thinking about like what the right incentive structures is for markets. Like I actually believe in markets. Like I think they're good things. In general, like when I'm playing a game or like trying to do something, I like to sort of, you know, like tell me what the rules are and then like give me the autonomy to go off and do what I can do within the bounds of the rules. But like, it doesn't mean that, you know, the rules that we have for capitalism right now are like the, you know, sort of inviolable, like absolutely correct rules that have to be in order to support this market dynamic that supports all of this innovation. You know, I don't know how close or far away from, you know, sort of skirting like any sort of terrible lines there are. But like, I do think that this dynamic that you point out where, you know, you sort of can very easily get into this cycle where, you know, it's growth for growth's sake is like not a great thing. It's one of the reasons I enjoy my role at Microsoft right now because, you know, like you think about our mission, it's empower every individual and organization on the planet to achieve more. And, you know, like we've got this heritage as a platform company. And so like you've got this nice alignment where we win when the customers who are using our technology to build the things that matter to them win. And like, I think we need more of those, you know, sort of win-win alignment things.
So let me stop you for 1 minute here, right? Like, so this is an interesting conversation to have. You just shared your mission statement. You know, Google had its own mission statement. Facebook had its own mission statement. In this world of platforms, of these big, gigantic companies, I mean, Microsoft, by no stretch of imagination, is a small company.
No, right? Not.
Do mission statements matter when all that people care about is...
No, they matter.
Know, like how this last quarter did.
Well, they matter a lot to the extent that the leadership and the employees of the company believe in the mission. So this mission for Microsoft is like something that Satya articulated when he took over the company like a handful of years ago. And like it really, you know, him constantly reinforcing it and the executive team constantly reinforcing it and us like taking action like on a daily basis that is consonant with the mission, like means that it becomes a reality. And Harari has like become, you know, maybe a little bit more popular out here than I'm usually like the one when like, you know, authors and ideas get a little bit too popular, I run away from them. But, you know, I sort of like this notion that he introduced in Sapiens that, you know, the thing that allows us to function as societies are like our ability to, you know, sort of create and share stories about like the world that we live in. And that like a lot of our constructs are really like shared fiction, you know, like I sort of said to a bunch of people, you know, like Microsoft, without a shared belief of like Microsoft's employees and customers, that it is a thing, would just be like a collection of real estate and some, you know, like data centers that are like in a progressive state of decay, with no one tending them. So, you know, I think missions in the sense that like at the very highest level, they are like a galvanizing force that sort of articulates, like, it's not specific enough to like inform, you know, like the work that you need to do to like get your thing launched or whatnot. But it's like, it can be a really powerful litmus test that you've got to like say like what's in or what's out.
Right. I mean, you know, I think I maybe there is a part of me which kind of gets a little cynical at times. But not a part of me, a big part.
Oh, dude, I'm totally cynical about mission statements.
But like, you know, you talk about people, you know, and how they get motivated. But it's the same people. You and I probably know many of them who left jobs at Apple and Cisco and all these big companies. And they went to go work for Juul, which is essentially selling, you know, like a drug to their kids. And people still were okay with it because it's the only way to live in Silicon Valley, Bay Area, because it costs a lot of money to live in. So you will do the dance with the devil in many ways. So that's why I kind of wonder why, you know, even if mission statements, should we even be thinking about them? Anyway, let's turn to more positive things. I do not want to talk about negative things. I want to talk about the cloud, the data, the machine learning, all the cool technologies which are out there, which make me so excited about today and tomorrow.
Yeah.
I want to know what is exciting you about those things. What's your view of the world of technology?
Yeah. You know, the thing that excites me from the first programs that I wrote when I was a little kid, I've always been interested in the platform part of computing. It's like, I've always thought about like, what can I do that somebody else can then use to go make something? And over time, God, it's a long time now, really long time. So many decades now that I've been doing this, the level of abstraction that people, the level of abstractions that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis to create things has gotten higher and higher and higher. So it's like really amazing, like what you can sit down and do that would have been difficult or impossible to do just a few years ago. And I'm sort of excited about like how those abstractions like are going to continue to get raised, maybe at an accelerating pace over the next decade. And like AI is one of those places where, you know, if I think back to the first project, real project that I did at Google was what by today's standards is a relatively simple machine learning classification problem. It took me a bunch of months to, you know, build this thing. And then it was in production for a really long while in the ad system. Today, I could sit down with some of the frameworks that we have and like cloud training and whatnot. And like I could build something that's better than this sorry old piece of crap that I built 12 years ago, built in 2004. So it was like 15 years ago in like a couple of days. And so like that's a really exciting idea for me. And like I think there's this self-reinforcing feedback loop with machine learning where you're going to start to see machine learning itself, like changing what the programming paradigm actually looks like. So you're going to go less away from like programming, you know, for the past couple hundred years since like Lady Ada Lovelace like sat down and like wrote the first, you know, the first modern program has been about like somebody sitting down and understanding like all of the complexity of a machine. And like using a bunch of these sort of techniques and abstractions to bridge the gap between a human conception of a problem and like what this machine is able to do in service of solving it. It's not a, you know, sort of an accessible activity for a lot of people. Like even folks, you know, I think who could do it. Like I look at my wife, she's smarter than I am, right? Like my wife could totally like be a better engineer than I am. But like she looks at this whole, you know, sort of programming business is like, why would anybody, you know, want to do this? Like, I just sort of can't imagine. And so like, I think, you know, AI machine learning like has the real possibility over the next few years to like turn programming into more of a teaching activity where it's less about telling a machine exactly how to solve a problem and more about teaching a machine like how to solve a problem in human terms.
So sort of like how, you know, in the early days of Industrial Revolution, you knew exactly how to make the machine work.
Yep.
And then you knew how to make parts.
Yep.
Not the machine. You didn't care about how the machine worked.
Yep.
In like towards the end of, in let's say 1970, 80s onwards, we've seen more and more robotic, you know, automation of the industrial processes,
yep,
where focus is on making things rather than knowing how the machine works. So
yep,
you see the same parallels in the software domain as well.
Well, it's been on this inexorable trend. You know, you just sort of trace back over like the last 60 years or so. You know, you go from, you know, writing in machine code where you're like flipping, you know, like switches to like binary code, you know, assembly instructions into a machine to like bootstrap its punch paper tape reader so it can get like its next level bootloader in memory, to today where you can sort of sit down at a web browser and like punch a few buttons and like you've got a scalable cluster spun up that can like serve as much web traffic as you want, right? So like there's this huge like abstraction gap between these, right? And like the thing that I'm saying is like I think it's going to get even more powerful, you know, from an abstraction perspective, where you're not even going to need to be, you know, like an engineer with a software engineering degree or a computer scientist to like be able to harness a lot of this power. You're just going to be able to say like, hey, I got this problem. Like, you know, let me describe it to you. And the machine is going to be able to go sort it out.
You know, I get excited about all that stuff. But when I think about that, I also think about the phase, which is going to be where, you know, right now we have this two-dimensional idea of technology and how we access it. Like in a sense, you know, there is a screen and there is a keyboard or touch.
Yep.
But, you know, I think about the world where compute is accessible to us,
yep,
through haptic mechanisms.
Yep.
And I'm just like, I don't know what advertising looks like in that format. Hopefully it's not there. Something else comes around, how we consume media,
yep,
what media is. What is productivity? What is writing software in that time?
Yep.
I think to me, when I think about that, I don't know when that's going to happen. But that's the exciting part of all these,
yeah,
technologies and when they merge together.
I totally
Do you
agree.
Have a guess on how long before we see that future emerge?
Look, I think it's coming. You can sort of see the, you know, the first glimmers of it right now, like all of these voice powered devices that are showing up in the marketplace is sort of like what phase it is, but like it's sort of the current phase. One of the things that I spend a bunch of time thinking about is like, what do we need to create from a platform perspective to make it easier to create a larger diversity of these devices? Because I don't think the right answer is like you've got one thing and it's got like, you know, 12 million skills and it solves all of your problems. Like, I think the more likely world that we'll live in is, you know, like we're sitting here in a conference room right now having this conversation, and there's like a thermostat, a lighting controller, and a clock on the wall, and a TV, and like all of these things are going to have powerful enough compute embedded in them over the coming years where they'll be able to do first level AI stuff. So like they'll, you know, should you equip them with a camera, they will be able to see and respond to gestures and your position. And like maybe they can read your body language and your mood and sort of adapt the environment to suit your needs. Like they may have voice sensors so that you can talk to them. They may have like a whole bunch of other, you know, temperature sensors or infrared cameras, blah, 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 right? And it's super exciting to me to think about a world where, like right now, it's sort of difficult to build one of those devices because you have to sort of, every intelligent device you've got in an environment is its own little vertically integrated stack of things. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of have designed it from the ground up. There are relatively little standards. I mean, there are better standards for embedded systems than there were 20 years ago, where it like really was like roll your own. Like now you've got, you know, some reasonable choices for, you know, your board level infrastructure, like Raspberry Pis and Arduinos and, you know, like a bunch of different things like that. And, you know, even Android, you know, for instance, is like a pretty good platform for building embedded systems. but like, it's still, it's not enough. It's so hard to like build one of these things. And so like, I think the next layer of services need to come in over the next few years. And when it does, like, you know, I think you really can have real ubiquitous intelligent computing in your life where we can build smarter software.
I think that would be the more fun part. This perception computing is what I'm excited about. Before we go, there are two things I want to talk about.
Yep.
So what does a CTO of Microsoft really do?
Well, you know, I think the CTO title is, it means a bunch of different things depending on which company you're at. Like sometimes people use CTO as a synonym for like head of engineering and like, you know, the person, you know, he or she is running an entire group of engineers. At some places, like a CTO is like an outbound person who spends most of their time chatting with customers. The flavor of CTO that I am at Microsoft is I'm the person who's trying to help our CEO and my peers on the leadership team try to figure out like where all of the things are that fall, technology things that fall between the gaps in their organizations. So like what are common pieces of infrastructure we need to build to support like all of our ambitions at Microsoft? Like where are the places where we're unnecessarily duplicating effort? You know, what are the investments that we should be making that, you know, if you sort of think about them in like any of the individual groups, like don't have enough critical mass to like, you know, get proper investment. And then, you know, I tend to think, spend about 30% of my time thinking about like right now and 70% of my time thinking about like, what are we going to really regret not doing 3 to 5 years from now if we don't start soon? And so like what is a practical matter that's meant for me over the past 2 years is I spent a bunch of time thinking about AI because it's one of those things that, and like, I shouldn't even say AI is like a junk word. I spent a lot of time thinking about machine learning and it is one of those things where doing machine learning really well requires substantial amounts of investment, doing it in a way where your internal investments can be packaged up in ways that become platforms for people outside of the company is like really hard and requires a little bit of extra effort that like might otherwise seem unnatural, but it's really important to do if you believe that machine learning is like one of these very important, you know, sort of platform technologies that we're building for the future. You want to make sure it's accessible to everyone to use. And then, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, like once you have a platform that lets you do really effective machine learning, then, you know, it sort of supports a bunch of different things, you know, like from gaming to Office to search to, it will become like one of those sort of repertoire things for computer scientists and programmers where like everybody needs to have it in their bag of tricks.
I think in part two of our conversation, we should talk about all those things. But before I go, let's talk about Kevin, the photographer. What have you been up to when it comes to photography? Yeah. And how did you start taking photos and like what prompted you?
My first photos I took were when I was a little kid. My mom bought me a Bugs Bunny instant camera. You know, it was one of those like little film camera things. It was a kid's toy, but it took real pictures. And I've got this whole roll of film and a bunch of prints. The first pictures that I ever took were the back of my little brother's head. I think I was 7 and he was like 3.5 at the time. And like, I'm chasing him around, like snapping these photos and all I've got are like his curls blowing in the wind. And like, he gave me the best present ever a few years ago. Like, he tracked this camera down on eBay that my mom and like found one that was still in its original packaging and like gave it to me. And it's like in my prize camera collection right now. Like, I've got a many cameras and like that one is the one that's the most special to me. And so, you know, it's interesting. It's always been about taking pictures of people. Like, I've done a little bit of landscape work and I know like you really love landscape photography. like I've never like developed a real emotional connection with landscape photography. I enjoy doing it, but like it's not the thing that, you know, sort of replenishes my you know, sort of creative reserves. And so like I do a bunch of portrait photography and have for a bunch of years.
Yeah. But you're a very people's person. I know you've been doing a lot of work around helping people in other parts of America and like teaching them or giving them skills to be more equipped for the future, which is more automated. So I think it doesn't surprise me that you like taking photographs of people, whereas I like taking photographs of rocks because rocks don't talk back.
Yeah. It's, you know, it is a little odd because I am a capital I introvert. Like you say, I'm a people person and I don't know where it comes from. I care a lot about people and as you mentioned, like I really, really care about rural people and, you know, sort of folks who like may feel like their future is a little less unsure. And like, I hope I can help a little bit, like make their future feel a little bit more hopeful. And like, I also love those parts of the country. Like I just like have a deep affection for them. And like, you know, the people there are amazing. And like, you know, there's an enormous amount of dignity that they all have in like their communities and whatnot. But I'm an introvert. So like, it's odd that I've chosen portrait photography as my photographic medium, because like, I'd be perfectly happy going, you know, home tonight and sitting in a dark room and like not talking to anyone for a while.
Well, I don't know if I will classify you as an introvert, because every time I meet with you, I leave with more questions and I desire to spend more time with you. And thank you, Kevin, for just a great conversation. I could go on for a couple of more hours, but I know
you have
a very important job to do versus me who likes to just gab. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And it's been an honor and a pleasure.
A ton of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.